Mom deserves better than a drugstore card. This Mother's Day, surprise her with a truly special personalized card from Moonpig. Add your favorite photos, a heartfelt message, and we'll even mail it for you the same day, all for just $5. From mom to grandma, we have something to celebrate every mom in your life. Every mom deserves a Moonpig card. Get 50% off your first card at Moonpig.com.
Moonpig.com.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Today's episode has been sponsored by Jay McLachlan. Jay McLachlan is a timeless lifestyle brand with incredible style and a spirit of connection. I am obsessed with Jay McLachlan and have been so honored that they are sponsoring my Zibbyverse tour. It just so happens that the tour goes to so many communities and areas of the country that have Jay McLachlan stores. And I love that the brand is philanthropic through Jay McLachlan's local and loyal programming. Host store events to give back to organizations that are meaningful to Jay McLachlan's local communities. I also love the fact that the clothes are just so chic. They make me feel polished and modern. And the best part is that most of the line comes in fabrics that don't wrinkle. I especially love the dresses, the cashmere sweaters, the other sweaters. You'll see them all over my Instagram. I typically tag at Jay McLachlan. And so you can check it out. It is absolutely one of my favorite brands, and I am over the moon excited to be working with them. In fact, I want to share the love with all of you. Jay McLachlan is giving 20% off new customers and listeners of my podcast with special code ZIBBY20. Capital ZIBBY 20. That's 20% off for new customers and listeners of the podcast with special code capital ZIBBY20. Take advantage of it today. My favorites are this white, open, long cashmere sweater that I've been wearing on every flight that I've taken on this tour. I have a blue with light blue horizontal striped sweater, several dresses I even wore on Good Morning America. Check it out, Jay McLachlan. Thanks so much.
Hi, this is Zibby Owens, and you're listening to the award-winning podcast, Moms Don't Have Time to Read Books. I'm also the host of Moms Don't Have Time to Lose Weight, and I'm the editor of the anthology, which you should run out and buy, called Moms Don't Have Time To, a quarantine anthology. All proceeds of that book go to COVID-19 vaccine research. And I'm the editor-in-chief of Moms Don't Have Time to Write, a new publication on Medium, and we're accepting submissions, so please send your personal essays there. And if all that isn't enough, you can follow me on Instagram at Zibby Owens, and my website is ZibbyOwens.com. Okay, now back to this amazing podcast. I am obsessed with Slumberkins. They're these collections of stuffed animals and loveys that come with books. And they're so much more than that. Slumberkins were developed by a therapist and an educator using research-based techniques to help teach children how to understand and support their feelings. So these are almost emotional intelligence teaching animals. My kids are just obsessed. I mean, they fight over all of these things so much. And each one comes with a book. And in the book, you do things like recite your feelings and learn about different emotions. There's the caring crew of animals, the confidence crew. There's the resilience crew. It's really amazing. They have great gifts for newborn parents. And they're giving my listeners and followers Zibby 10, 10% off your first purchase. The code is ZIBBY10. So go to slumberkins.com. Check it out. Your kids will love them, and you will love the fact that they help kids fall asleep better. They create an activity that you can do with your kids, reading, reciting. They even have like digital books that you can do as activities with your kids. I am just such a huge fan of this brand and what it does for families and how it will help kids, and also the fun that it brings into the household. So go to Slumberkins. Code ZIBBY10 will get you 10% off your first purchase. Enjoy!
Meg Mason is the author of Sorrow and Bliss, a novel.
She says in her bio, Meg is a writer, to begin with, of newspapers, the Financial Times and the Times London, then of magazines, Vogue, Elle, Marie Claire, GQ, Sunday Style, and the New Yorker's Daily Shouts. Now she is a writer of books. Her first novel, You Be Mother, was published in 2017, then Sorrow and Bliss, first published in Australia in 2020 and the US in February 2021. It will be released in the UK in June. Welcome, Meg. Thank you so much for coming on Moms Don't Have Time to Read Books to discuss Sorrow and Bliss.
Thank you so much. It's such a pleasure.
Would you mind telling listeners what your novel is about?
Sure. I'm getting better at this. It's so difficult to tell someone in such a short, you know, I'm like, I can kind of do an elevator pitch as long as the elevator is stalled. That's kind of where I'm up to. It has to be a stuck elevator. To me, it's a love story about Martha and Patrick. It's the love story kind of told from the very beginning of their relationship when they're teenagers, when they first meet each other, all the way to Martha's early 40s when the book opens and things seem to be on their last legs in terms of their relationship. Within that, it pivots on mental illness is a strong theme that runs through it. That is why, you know, we've arrived at the point where they both seem to be at their end. And then I think as well, through exploring that it's a coming of age, because a delayed coming of age, because Martha at 40 kind of has to make these decisions that finally force her to grow up in a way that I think a lot of us experience. I think, you know, the idea that a coming of age occurs when you're a teenager, you know, just about to enter college, 18, you drive across country. That didn't do it for me. Do you know what I mean? That's not when I grew up. It was much later than that, after life had had its kind of way with me. Do you know what I mean? Like marriage and children and all of those things. That's what forces you to kind of be like, oh, no one's coming to save me. You know, no one's coming to rescue me. And you're faced with these decisions of how do I proceed? And I think that's where we meet Martha. So it's those three things tied together.
Wow. So, and where did this book come from? Where did the idea come from? And by the way, I love that you have a whole passage in here when Martha is thinking about writing and is annoyed that people always think that her autobiographical work is autobiographical. And I'm like, well, I can't ask her now if it's autobiographical, because even her character says it's not autobiographical.
It served its purpose. No, it's fine. I think there are some little jokes through there that are just, I guess I snuck them in. This is my third book. And I guess I kind of, you know, the extent to which Martha is, you know, there are parts of her that, of course, are based on things I've experienced. And I think all authors have a really tricky relationship with that question, because I always feel like if anyone wants to ask me anything, then I'm lucky, because, you know, they could also equally well not be interested and ignore the book completely. And so, you know, I think it's an interesting question. I've asked it of authors myself as a journalist, but it's so hard because we're so, you know, it's that mixture, it's imagination. I'm answering it for you right now, even though you didn't ask it. It's partly imagination. It's partly, you know, things that you've seen or witnessed. And especially for me, you know, this kind of ties into where the book came from, but this was my Hail Mary pass of a novel. This was going to be the last one. It wasn't even going to exist. And so anything that I'd felt, heard, seen, it all went in there within these characters. But then as well, I think authors are so insecure and so prideful. It's a funny combination, which I think Anne Lamott has kind of talked about, that we have these enormous egos and yet we're so insecure that when someone assumes that it must just be you with the names changed, you feel like you don't think I'm capable of doing anything other than, you know, the thinly veiled thing. So, you know, that's why it's, you know, uneasily. And that's why I snuck a little reference into that, I guess, anticipating the question slightly. But no, I'm very happy to answer it. Where the book came from is, I guess, like the ash heap of my career would probably be the most realistic way to describe it. It's just, yeah, the potted summary is that I'd spent all of 2018 on a novel that I got to the end and I knew it had been wrong since maybe February, and I couldn't just give up. And then the more words you acquire, you know, that you build, then you can't give it up once it's 40,000. And then, you know, at 60,000, you're like, oh, I wish I'd just got rid of it at 40. You know what I mean? But it keeps going and it keeps going. And you know, as a writer, especially if it's your first book, you know it's hard. You know it's not, you know, there will be bad days, but there was only bad days. And that showed so clearly on the page. And I arrived at the end. It was sort of due in a week. I think it was, you know, 85,000 words by then. And it was just bad. It was just, you know, and it wasn't me being like, oh, it's terrible. And I want my publisher to tell me it's great. It was, I didn't even want her to read it, which is what the note said that I attached to it. And then yeah, it was just that I was showing it to her to be like, I tried. And so I'm quitting having tried. And how do I give you an advance back, especially an advance that I had spent many months ago? And that was going to be tricky. So she was amazing. I don't know how publishers do it, because, you know, to mop up the emotion and to just sort of tell you it's going to be all right and to not put any pressure on me to be like, well, go away and redraft it, you know, start over and do it again. She just let me go. And I just, you know, it sounds so dramatic and ridiculous, but I did have this grieving period because this is what I wanted to do with my life. I remember writing my first novel when I was 8, and, you know, it's still somewhere in a shoebox on my granny's word processor. She must have loved it, because I went into her little study for hours and hours and hours to, you know, work on my craft. And anyway, so then, of course, you know, a few weeks pass, and the idea that became that first section in the book at Martha and Patrick at a wedding, it just came, you know, those little scenes and pictures just drop into your mind. I don't know where. And I wrote it down, and then somehow it just opened some sort of floodgates, I think. But again, it was months until I had showed anyone, told my publisher, even considered it as a novel. But because that's where I think that tone comes from, and that kind of very, compared to what I've done before, the tone is quite straight. There's no novelizing in there. There's no me trying to perform to an audience. It's just, I just let Martha tell this story of hers as though she was speaking to you. So, you know, if I was chatting to you, I wouldn't be ramming my sentences full of adverbs and, you know, exciting adjectives instead of just walking and sitting and eating, which is what, you know, that's the sort of language she uses. So I think, but I'm so glad that that was the upshot of that work style, because I think that the danger with a book about mental illness is that it would be overwhelming if I was trying to perform with the writing as well. You know, this material can be really heavy, and it's quite emotional in and of itself, of course. So if I was trying to amp that up instead of tone that down with this funny prosaic language, I think people would have been like, oh, gee, you do what I mean by kind of chapter two, it's too hard. I think I need some Nora Ephron. So it's somehow that's how it evolved. And here we are, I guess.
Wow. Well, that was a really interesting answer. Thank you for that. Wow. Well, I think that this type of writing deserves just as much credit. I mean, this was you get immersed immediately into Martha's consciousness, and you go through it all with her. And just because the words aren't SAT words or aren't multisyllabic in every single chance doesn't mean it's not as effective. I mean, I think that's your point as well, but I don't know. I found it, I wasn't sitting here reading it thinking like, oh, this is so unliterary.
This is so basic.
It doesn't feel basic at all. In fact, it feels like, so you're so witty. Like, I love that sort of like British wit. I don't know how you all like, somehow it's like so much funnier than anybody in America, the way your sense of humor. I'm just going to group it as an entire nation or something.
Oh, do it. Absolutely. I'm so happy to be classed, because I'm a New Zealand born writer, but I live in Australia. So I guess I have somehow from being in London for
not,
a few years.
Not British then.
Commonwealth, I guess. Commonwealth.
Commonwealth humor. I'm sorry. I didn't mean.
No, that's fine. No, it's British humor, but somehow I've absorbed it. I think that's what I, you know, the stuff that you watch or read as you're, you know, a teenager. And that was what I completely lived on. So all of that sort of thing, French and Saunders and all of that. But I was nervous about it coming out in the US because it's portrayed as a British, it's portrayed as a funny story. Like, that's kind of in all the materials, but I'm like, not laugh out loud. Do you know what I mean? Like, can we just tell everybody it's not, there's no jokes in there. Do you know what I mean? There's no callbacks and buildups and all of that sort of thing. It's just those little observations and absurdities. And I always think of it as it's the British Office compared to the US Office TV show. So if you didn't like the British Office and it was too dark, maybe, you know what I mean? It's going to be more of a struggle. But if that's what you, if that's your flavor, then I'm glad that people enjoy it that way.
Even like your really subtle scenes, like when Patrick asks Martha if she likes, he's like, do you like old movies? And she's like, no, no one does. And he's like, okay, want to go at 7:30? And she's like, of course.
Yeah.
And he's like, do you want to? It's just so simple. Yeah. But you had like, no, he said, she said, it's just like, perfect. I don't know. It's just funny.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. And it helped as well to kind of have that personality of hers to fall back on when there are scenes like she finally acquires this diagnosis after 20 years of searching, or 15, because, you know, the last 5 she gave up and decided it was just her awful personality and that she's a terrible person. And that was what was informing all her decisions. But she reaches this moment where the psychiatrist who she sort of finally found makes this pronouncement. And I was glad to have her ability to kind of reduce that moment right down to a joke rather than her having to express that, oh my goodness, you know, the mystery of my existence has been solved, because we don't talk like that. We would never say that in the context of a doctor's office. We would say what she says, which is, oh, well, if it's that, I hope it's the 24-hour kind, you know, because you diffuse that emotion that's too extreme a lot of the time. And so I was glad to have that function to rely on. And then, of course, there's her sister who takes it a level further in terms of the darkness and the humor and that sort of thing. So they were a good pair to be able to explore and fall back on.
And tell me what part of the mental illness piece attracted you to writing about it. There were so many scenes, like even when she's flushing the pills down the toilet, for instance, or when she's first with Jonathan, or the moment where she's back in the house and she's finds like an old discarded expired prescription for whatever. And she's like, I'm just going to take this and see what happens. All her time on the couch and just, oh my gosh, you just like wanted to, I felt like I wanted to hug her so many times and like, you
know, that's good.
Got her mom across the face.
Like, yes, she's tricky. Celia, her mother's tricky. I think it is because I had read somewhere a long time ago that women will face a much longer journey to get a diagnosis than men, with particular conditions that I researched into when I thought I might use one real condition in there and not the kind of amalgam, the unnamed amalgam that I eventually went with for all sorts of reasons. I had read that, you know, in some cases, not with anxiety and depression, but with the more complex the schizophrenia is or bipolar, usually it will take a man, say on average 5 years or something, to find a diagnosis. A woman will be looking at upwards of a decade, because there's that residual, I guess, you know, discrimination or imbalance in the medical system where she's hysterical, she's hormonal, she's premenstrual, she needs a baby, you know, whatever it is. We don't, I think, and still to this day, to a degree, necessarily get the same acknowledgement of being aware that something is wrong, because men don't really go to the doctor unless they're, you know, sort of on death's door. So if they come in, they must be serious. But if we come in, we had a free morning and decided to, you know, go chat to a doctor about some tiny invented condition. So I think I wanted to explore the difficulty of her actually, not so much what the condition was like, but what it was like to try and find that and to be misdirected and to be dosed up with things that didn't work, and she knew it was making her worse or doing nothing, and the trial and error in that, because that's exhausting, if you know, for people who I think have been through that, or people with any kind of chronic pain, migraine or whatever it is, to try and find someone who will listen to you and not patronize you. You know, very first doctor you see her going to when she's just experienced this kind of mental collapse at 17, which she describes as the little bomb going off in her brain, he sort of, it's like, it's so obviously glandular, well, what we call glandular fever. I think that's mono in your country. It's so obviously mono. I'm not even going to test for it. And there's no medication I can give you, but you know what teenage girls are like. They love a tablet. So here's an iron tablet. It'll give you something to swallow, kind of thing. And so she leaves feeling mad from that first moment, you know, or minimized. And so I think that was the part of mental health that interests me, rather than the ins and outs of necessarily what it feels like from the inside, which I'm maybe not so qualified or didn't feel so qualified to present as fact.
That's funny you say that, because in the book, I don't think you changed it to mono. So I was like, what? Because then you said, you know, to your father, like, oh, she's been kissing too many boys. And he's like, have you been kissing boys or something like that? And she was like, no. And I was like, why would she be kissing boys? Anyway, now I understand. Oh.
Glandular fever is apparently transmitted that way.
It was, no, mono is transmitted that way.
Oh, good. Oh,
yes.
Good.
No, I just missed that reference.
Yeah, no, fair enough.
And, you know, another element that I thought was so sort of poignant throughout the book is her relationship to this sort of unborn child along the way, right? This fetus that she always refers to. And even the moment when she's on the double-decker bus with her head to the window and she sees like a mom with a book propped up on her belly, which I feel like I could do these days even without a baby in my belly. And like another mom comes over and they're chit-chatting and she's like, okay, right then, I'm not going to have kids. You know. And then of course things change and change again and all this stuff. So tell me a little bit about her, you know, ambivalence, I guess, and fear. I feel like a lot of it was fear.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Mom deserves better than a drugstore card. This Mother's Day, surprise her with a truly special personalized card from Moonpig. Add your favorite photos, a heartfelt message, and we'll even mail it for you the same day, all for just $5. From mom to grandma, we have something to celebrate every mom in your life. Every mom deserves a Moonpig card. Get 50% off your first card at Moonpig.com.
Moonpig.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Yeah, well, she is instructed by sort of, I guess it's doctor number two, who prescribes her something. And this is still in her very late teens, and says, if you take this, you need to be really careful not to get pregnant because this is unsafe for a fetus. And I think in the way that, you know, as we get older, especially at my age now, I've learned that doctors, you know, I mean, bless them for all that they do and all of their hard work and sacrifice for us and care for us. But there are doctors who, I guess, make these pronouncements as if there's truth. And I think when you're Martha's age or teen, you just accept them. You don't question. That's a doctor. They know. The certificates are all over their wall. And so I will just take that, you know, advice or that diagnosis wholesale. When you get older, you know, especially, I guess, if you've had children and there's that massive opinion and conflicting opinion, and like, actually, I know. I instinctively know. And I will go and find a doctor who will listen until, you know, that's kind of acknowledged. But she takes it as truth that these pills are dangerous. And even though she will come off those, there's something about that message that she absorbs that the pills are dangerous, but the extension of that is that she is dangerous. And she has this condition that she doesn't understand, but develops this sense within herself and then stokes it and expands it that she would be dangerous as a mother and that she would be unsafe to her child. And so this is whether or not she even wanted children at that age, which we're far too young to kind of imagine ahead that much. She goes into marriage and into that age with that pre-knowledge. And so that informs all her decisions. And she decides that it isn't safe. And she has a brief kind of flirtation with the idea when she, in that disastrous first marriage to Jonathan, who's this very charismatic, you know, art dealer who creates this sense of her being amazing. And he's the first woman to kind of, you know, and they're so wrong for each other. You can sort of see it from the disastrous public proposal, which doesn't suit her at all, to, you know, their very quick marriage and very short engagement. And he sort of tells her, it'd be amazing, let's do it. And she briefly wants to believe that maybe she's the person that Jonathan thinks she is. And so she goes off her medication, instantly crashes. And then it sort of proves to her, I can't live without this medication. You know, it's true. I never should be a mother. And so, but I think the function of that for her, and she's obviously someone who isolates herself and puts herself outside regular, I guess, female experience. She doesn't have a lot of female friends because as she gets older, they all have children. And you know what it's like? It's hard to keep finding that common ground, whether you're the mum with who can only talk about your kids and you've got this single gorgeous friend who blows in and tells you about the big night she had before, you know, the night before. And it's hard to find that commonality, but it pushes Martha outside the female experience. And so she ends up feeling disconnected from other women who've done that and become mothers. And then, of course, it challenges her relationship with Ingrid, who is crazy fertile and is just busting out these babies every kind of 18 months. So that's, I guess that's her relationship. But then there's a twist in it where we find out what her relationship has really been like to motherhood.
Wow. So you mentioned at the beginning, so now I have to go back to this, that your coming of age was more at age 40 with kids and everything else. So
yeah,
what was the turning point for you? Did something happen or was it just growing up? Or tell me if there was a moment.
Yeah.
Or...
yeah, no, definitely. Well, I mean, really the opposite to Martha, I got married when I was 22. So at this point, I've nearly been married for more than half my life. And I had my first daughter when I was 25. So I almost have no experience of being an adult without also being a mother. But So I guess it's almost a case of, you know, if you don't have that extra decade, I guess, to explore who you are and do all of those things and focus on yourself because you're focusing on this little baby instead and then her sister who came along, you know, 2.5 years later, you just get absorbed into that. And you do, I think, would it be safe to say that we all lose a little bit of identity, or we all kind of have our essential selves slightly broken down by that experience and we have to rebuild ourselves? So it wasn't until they were teenagers where I sort of emerged from that tunnel and went, oh, like, I never did that growing up thing, so I guess I better do it now. Because, you know, it's not like you don't develop maturity as a mother, but I think as a person, I was stopped at 25. That's where my exploration of my own character had, you know, had taken its temporary 15-year pause. And so I kind of had to look at myself and be like, am I still acting in ways that I was at 25, especially in my marriage, I think, because you know how that, and this is what I put into Martha and Patrick, but you know how that dysfunction, whatever your dysfunction is in your relationship, that got built in very early. Like, that was probably already there before there was even a ring on your finger. And so if you don't address that, it becomes so embedded and you find that 15, 20 years later, you're still acting out of that one place or that one disappointment that never was resolved. And so I think there was a lot of that that was waiting for me on the other side of children. So then it was like, okay, I'm going to take a pretty cold look at, you know, who I am and weed out some stuff that should have been weeded out a long time ago. So I think it was that slow development of like, and feeling when I hit 40 that like, oh, I am a bit more of a grown up than I was. And I do actually know stuff about, you know, how things work and that sort of stuff.
This reminds me of the scene when she goes to breakfast, well, kind of breakfast, but she's still in the bridesmaid's dress and everything with Patrick. And he's taking forever to order. And she was so happy because she didn't, I loved how you said how she's tired of people letting her go. I'll let you go. I'll let you go. She's like, no, I want somebody to have me stay. I want him to stay.
Yeah, exactly.
So, and she's like, I love that he took his time ordering. And she's like, later on at their like anniversary, you said how she like grabbed the menu from him and was like,
she's
oh,
like,
still
just
have
choose
the
something.
Yeah, just exactly. Get the, he'll have the steak.
Exactly. It was this, it had evolved into that thing of like, I can't bear that thing anymore. That thing was so charming at the beginning. And now if you do that one more time, you know what I mean? It's over between a divorce face kind of look happening. So yeah, I think, but that's what I loved exploring about that long arc, you know what I mean, of a relationship. Because there are, of course, those intensely romantic proposal moments or whatever moment you sort of, they're the highlights, but there's a lot of low lights, or at least midlights. Do you know what I mean? A long relationship where it's like you're together and you're at home and you're cooking dinner, and where's the romance in that? You have to try pretty hard to find it. But sometimes those greatest moments of connection are on the sofa or on a walk. And I think that was fun to explore them, and in between the start when you meet them and the end, what happened in the middle is the interesting part to me.
So Meg, what are you working on next? Do you have another novel in the works?
I do. I'm in that phase where I'm like, oh goodness. And it's exciting. It's really exciting because I realize it's the only way to leave these characters behind is to go and find a new set of characters, because Martha and Patrick and their whole world has been my world for 2 years. And it's a real challenge to let them go and belong to other people. And which is, you know, I'm so happy to do it, but it's hard to break that connection because they do feel real, even though when authors say that, I used to just think, oh my gosh, they've lost their minds, that you made them up and now they're talking to you. Do you know what I mean? But it actually happens. And so that's what I'm most enjoying at the moment, is to find out who this next set of people are. Well, getting to feel nostalgic about the last crew. But yeah, so I'm working away, and I'm writing for screen as well and doing bits and pieces like that. So it's busy, but for me, it's about creating that belief again that no one's ever going to see it, because that was so key to my experience, that I have to try and convince myself somehow, which is getting harder and harder because of people like you, like getting the book out there, which I'm so grateful for, but I'm like, I have to pretend that I'm completely anonymous again. So I'll see how it goes.
I started writing something the other day and I felt so panicked that people were going to see it that I eventually at the top of my document typed draft 1 of 3.
Oh, that's a good idea.
Just so that I was like, I'll write 2 more. No one's going to see this one.
That is such a good idea. And isn't it funny? Because George Saunders describes that. I mean, he's just my absolute icon in every single way. He describes it as having to self-game, that you have to trick yourself into doing this thing, because I guess, you know, it's difficult work, but I think the tricky thing about it, I imagine if you're a surgeon, you turn up to your laparoscopic appendectomy knowing how you're going to do it. You know what I mean? You've done it 50 times before. You do it exactly that way again. That'll be a perfect job. You don't have to worry that maybe this time you've forgotten. Maybe your talent for appendectomies has left you. Do you know what I mean? There's nothing left in the tank. But with writers, we sit down, we're having to recreate from nothing again and again every single day, and to face up to that, what feels like those limitations and the edge of our talent that's not going to take us to the extent that, you know, we need to go. So my equivalent of draft one of three is I name all my documents like, you can do this. You've done it before and you'll do it again, .doc. You know what I mean? So every time I look up, there's this crazy, I mean, it's insane. A lot of madness goes down in this little shed that I work in. So, but whatever gets you there, don't you think? You find your tricks. The longer 100%. You work, you find what works for you. But I might try that.
That's what I write on notes to my daughter, literally that. You've done it before and you can do it again. You've got this, you know.
Yeah,
we just exactly. All need to like take the notes we leave for our kids or something.
Exactly. We need to be our own cheerleaders. It's so true. It's so true. Even if it makes you feel crazy.
Yes. Well, I already feel crazy, but yeah. Do you have any other advice? This was, you already were sprinkling in bits and pieces, of course, but any advice to aspiring authors?
Oh, yes. No, I have definitely at this stage, I have definitely acquired a lot of tricks like that. I think it's about finding what works for you and then sticking to it and not waiting. Just if you can't write today, there's no way you're going to write tomorrow. Do you know what I mean? There's no perfect tomorrow coming where suddenly you'll sit down and there'll be this enormous flow of words. And you do hear lots of writers explain that it's a muscle, which is true, and that you build it up as you keep going. I think definitely if you set a word target for yourself, maybe 500, because it's not impossible to face 500 words a day. And if you do a great 500, you'll have momentum in the next day. But if you're having a terrible day, still just 500, you know what I mean? Like it's not too intimidating. But I think that you need to do that 500 every day and turn up. And I know with anything I'm doing, I need to work on it 7 days a week, because if you fall out of it for 2 days, it is so hard to get back in. And you kind of then have to go and read over it to remember where you were up to. And that takes a week by the time you get to a certain limit. So even if you just look at it and correct some grammar or something just every day to turn up for the work, because it just saves you a lot of reentry. I think reentry is painful, and it's a lot of time spent doing that. So I think that's what I've learned. But yeah, just to find your own way and then stick to that.
Sounds like how I feel about the gym. It's like once I take a few days off, it's like impossible.
But exactly.
I'm doing it every day. It's been, like, yeah. Just another day, you know.
Exactly. Otherwise you're like, I've never been to the gym before. I physically don't know how to do this. Like this is too.
What's going on?
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. We trick ourselves. We learn the tricks to get ourselves there.
Yes. Well, thank you. Thank you, Meg. Thanks for talking about Sorrow and Bliss. I really loved it. I love the characters too. So I see why you're very attached, and you know, maybe we can do some cameos in your next book, like the Jefferson, like those old TV
shows. Oh, yeah, that's a good idea.
Where, like, they pop in for coffee or something.
Yeah, I'll write the story of the woman who had the canapé, and we'll see Martha from the other side.
Exactly.
See if she was, you know, did the
that could be a fun exercise.
Exactly. But thank you so much. It's been lovely to chat to you. And I'm so grateful to anyone who's read the book or passed the book on to someone or, you know, posted about it, because it wouldn't exist without all of that. So I'm really grateful. Thank you.
Of course. All right. Take care. Bye-bye.
Thank you, Slumberkins, for sponsoring today's episode. Again, use code ZIBBY10 to get 10% off your first purchase. Thanks for listening to this episode of Moms Don't Have Time to Read Books. Don't forget to follow me on Instagram at Zibby Owens and at Moms Don't Have Time to Read Books. Also sign up for my newsletter at ZibbyOwens.com and sign up for my virtual book club and meet lots of authors on Zoom every other week. Thanks so much to Steve and Ryan at Texture Sound for the sound editing. And thank you to Morning Moon Productions for providing this fantastic intro and outro music.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.